Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
We kick off our heavier news hour now with Senator Kim Lightford. She's a senator for the 4th Senate District. She is the Senate Majority Leader. She is the chair of the Senate Black Caucus. If I keep giving her introductions, we'll have no time to talk, so let's just get right to her. Senator, welcome to WGN Radio. Good to talk to you.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
Plenty to talk about.
Most certainly.
And let me just start, actually. I'm going to have you kind of put your Senate Black Caucus hat on a little bit, but I want to talk about the Anjanette Young case. Still in the news, the mayor releasing some emails. She's trying to, stay ahead of this situation after falling behind on it. Anjanette Young, just to remind some folks, is the woman where, you know, cops burst into her apartment, and she was there naked, and they were in the wrong apartment. She kept telling them 40 times, you're in the wrong apartment. It was not a pleasant situation. Very poorly handled, and now it looks like the city's paying a price. But Senator, what's your take on the Anjanette Young case? And does this, you and I have talked before on my WGN TV political report show about the goals and the pillars of the Black Caucus, but that was before this event happened. This really puts this even more on the front burner, I would guess.
Well, you know, Paul, this is not new, and this is not unusual. It's just now being addressed in this open platform. Many African Americans, Black people in the city of Chicago and all across this state and country have been racially profiled year after year, need to be in a vehicle in their own home, sitting in their front yards, walking down the street, have been racially profiled. And here's an example of them looking for someone else, but busting in. I watched the video, and I've got to tell you, I teared up. Busting in this woman's home and allowing her to stand there and be so vulnerable, nude, and all of those officers there, one of the officers tell her to stop screaming, and she's like, oh my God, I'm telling you, you're in the wrong place, and then he told her to relax. Just degrading terminology used even in the midst of breaking into someone's home, and that's what they did. They broke into her home, and then they jarred her door with an ironing board at the very end of their stay there. And I just think it is the most degrading, disrespectful thing that could happen. And my heart and support and love goes out to her. I do not know her personally, but she is the face of so many other people that this has happened to.
So we've seen some heads have rolled. The corporation council had to resign. It even came out, even Mayor Lightfoot, I think, said she knew about this, you know, in the past. There was a delay in releasing this. Do you think this is a cover-up situation? Or what was propelled? I mean, knowing Mayor Lightfoot, I mean, it's not the kind of thing she'd want to cover up, but is this a matter of we've got to get a handle on this situation before we address it publicly? What do you think?
I believe they need to get a handle on it and should have, because even when you look at the tape even more for your listeners who have not looked at it, I would suggest that they do, because even the officers, when they went back into the car to check their paperwork, was like, oh my goodness, we're in the wrong place. And then the other officers who clicked their cameras off when they had the conversation. The whole point of body cameras is to protect not only the officers or the individuals, but to give an accurate accountability of what actually happened. And if you're an officer and you cut your camera off so that your conversation is not heard and no one can visibly see what's happening, that's where the problem lies. And that's the reason why the Black Caucus is looking to reform police accountability. They have to be accountable for the actions that they take. I know that we need law enforcement in our communities, but we also need law enforcement that's there to protect us and to make us feel safe and not feel threatened by their behavior.
So I want to talk to you about next steps and what has to happen. But in doing so, let me ask you this. If this event had happened in a different part of the city, in a place that, you know, we would say there's no systemic racism and the cops had gone into the wrong house, let's keep those facts the same. You might argue that, well, they would never have done that. But let's say they did. Out of curiosity, because you've studied these issues for so long, how do you feel the cops would have handled it differently in a house on the north side of the city facing a similar situation. What would they have done differently?
You know, I'd hope that they would do the same, but in reality, I know that they don't treat all things equal and all people equal. And I saw one woman officer, and I would have hoped she would have, I know she would have put clothes on that woman or provided a robe for her or figured out a way to at least throw a blanket over her and tie it from around her neck from the back so that it can just hang to cover her from the front. Mm. I know she would have did some type of way of making her feel less vulnerable. And I know that police who was yelling at her to relax and not to scream, I don't know that he would have done any of that as well. It's just those additional degrading opportunities that they just put on the black community. I've been a victim of this, and until it's noted that I'm an elected official or I'm a senator, conversations change slightly. They pull back their aggressiveness. But they shouldn't be so aggressive until they know the facts. And once the woman told them that I've been a 20-year social worker, no one's lived in this house with me in my 4 years, I work every day, I'm a law-abiding citizen, you have the wrong place. It should not have taken 40-plus times for her to tell them that. They should have been by now called in to check their references to make sure that they were, in fact, in the right place. And then I was further bothered that the gentleman that they were looking for has an ankle bracelet on, which means he has a home monitoring system, and they should have known what address that home monitoring system was tied to. So to me, they just did not do a thorough job before they went out, and that's because they were in the black community. Had they been up north, I'm pretty sure they would have checked over and over and over again to ensure that they were, in fact, going into the proper facility.
When we have talked before about this, you've talked about the fact that the Black Caucus has a four-pillar program to try and attack some of these issues we've been dealing with. And again, those pillars were created before the Anjanette Young situation, because there's been other situations. Just briefly, can you tell listeners what it is the agenda of the Black of the House and Senate Black Caucus is going to be to tackle these issues in the state?
Yes, I'd love to do so. So when you think about the living experience of being black in Illinois and then being a black legislator and making that connection, it wasn't difficult for us to come up with our four pillars. Our first pillar, criminal justice reform, police accountability, and violence reduction, will deal with those areas, changing the police certification and licensing process. We're wanting to remove police discipline from the collective bargaining process, look at reform and truth in sentencing and habitual criminal laws, and then also address changes to the money bond system by passing the Pretrial Fairness Act. And then those are just some of those areas that are highlighted. There's far more when it comes to each pillar. But for the second pillar is education and workforce development. We're definitely looking at the Black History curriculum reform. We've passed bills year after year to make sure that all of our history is being taught properly to our young people in the academia area, and it's still the same. So we're going to change that dynamic. We're looking around restorative justice practices and creating a whole child task force, removing barriers for teachers of color so that we can attract new African-American teachers and be able to retain them and give supports to existing teachers of color, and then looking to consolidate the workforce development programs. They're spread out all across different state agencies, and they're unable to provide the access and services for young people who are out of work and unskilled. Pillar three centers around economic access, equity, and opportunity, and we're definitely focused on building black businesses that are struggling to survive in disproportionately impacted areas. We're wanting to show neighborhood infrastructure as problem areas that need access to capital funding and to support experience with assistance programs. Environmental justice is so important. We want clean air, clean lead, clean water in our communities. So we have to address environmental justice. and then housing and employment access also in these disproportionately impacted areas that impact people who have a lived experience, homelessness, those who have been incarcerated, those who are youth who are disconnected from their families for various reasons. And so we have to make sure the lending practices are fair in disproportionately impacted areas and that affordable housing is available. And in another area, there is eliminating food deserts and equity in agriculture. And it's so sad to know that we don't have adequate produce in many of the African-American communities. So we're talking about give an example of poor food access and poor health outcomes in these disproportionately impacted areas. We're looking to support rural Black farmers and land loss issues that have existed in Pembroke Township and Hopkins Park and Black Oak Center. And then food hubs, incubators, and co-ops. We wanted to increase all business and workforce opportunities in local food systems. And then our fourth and final pillar of healthcare and human services, you know, we have to prohibit hospital closures, especially during the duration of the public health crises that we're in until December 31st of 2023. We're looking to establish training and certification requirements for community health workers, as well as requiring Medicaid reimbursements for community health worker services, and looking to create a Medicaid Managed Care Oversight Commission that's under the Healthcare and Family Services Department that would evaluate the programs with an emphasis on health outcomes, and requiring HFS to recommend additional populations that require MCO care planning with consideration of the social determinants of health. So that's in a nutshell some of the things that you will learn of and hear about that will be in draft form of legislation under each pillar.
And thank you. That was succinct. And we've just got about 2 minutes left, but I want to use that time to say, look, that's an ambitious agenda to be sure. I'm sure the budgets cross your desk. You probably notice a lot of red ink. How are we paying for this? And really the point at this stage of our interview, if I can just ask you, what should Illinoisans expect? I mean, to pay for those and other programs, are we getting hit with more property taxes and what's going to happen?
Well, you know, Paul, the state's budget is a reflection of its priorities. And there are a lot of priorities now that the state must face. There is no question about it. But there is nothing more fundamental to our families, our communities, and to the state than dismantling systemic racism that has embedded, has been embedded in our communities and our society for generations. And it's key to closing opportunity gaps that can break vicious cycles of poverty facing our communities. And this work must be top of our agenda. So it should be on the mind of all legislators.
I agree with you. I mean, again, ambitious, but here's the thing. Was it a mistake for the governor's budget to assume that the graduated income tax would pass and therefore he counted on a lot of revenue we're not going to have? I'm not questioning your objectives. I'm saying, was it a mistake to assume we'd have money that we're not going to have now?
You know, I don't know that it was. When we passed our budget in May of this year, we were new in the pandemic. I don't know if any of us anticipated still being in a pandemic and needing to have billions of dollars being spent on COVID relief. My hope is that the federal government will be more helpful with states and local government, and that we'll be able to streamline processes that is wasteful spending. And find ways to make sure that we address our priorities. I believe it's too soon to begin to talk about tax increases. We don't know if that's what's needed. There could be corporate loopholes and other things that we can take a look at. We just simply don't know at this point. I think our focus should still be on making sure that we're providing COVID relief for renters and mortgage lenders. We want to make sure we're not going to be more abusive to those that have been heavily impacted. And it's important that we make sure our health care providers and our essential workers are protected. And if they're wanting this vaccination, that is available to them. That should be our focus.
And we're going to monitor that as the session goes. Are y'all getting together for the next session?
We are looking to have a January session, absolutely. Our goal is January 8th.
Okay. Well, we'll monitor all of that. And, of course, as you know, I've known you for many years. I want to wish you, your family, especially your husband, who apparently is taking care of the snow chores and not you, a wonderful Happy New Year to all of you. Thank you for your time, Senator Kim Lightfoot of the 4th Senate District, the Senate Majority Leader. You got a lot of work ahead of you, and I appreciate you. Joining me on the phone now is Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat of Illinois' 8th District. Congressman, thank you for joining me here on WGN Radio.
Hey, Paul, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well. And, you know, I just, my guess is you've had a busier end of year this year, right? You probably used to be home with your family and you have parties, and now you got to explain to your wife why they're not seeing you.
You know, it's been interesting. I've been going back and forth so much just during the holiday time frame to D.C. that you never would have known that there is a holiday right now. But, you know, our president has managed to, increase our commuting, so to speak. And you know, it is what it is at this point. I go back on Saturday to get sworn in this weekend for a third term, and off we go.
And so let's talk about that, because this is a really magical time when the president, for example, wasn't deciding whether he would veto the COVID legislation and the omnibus budget. Had he done what is known as a pocket veto, which is just do nothing, that legislation would, as you know, just vanish with the end of the Congress. Okay, he signed it and that's done. But the work isn't done, because, as you know, the president is demanding $2,000 checks. Nancy Pelosi couldn't come out fast enough and say, we'll do that. And the House passed it. You did your job. I know I'm asking you some Senate questions, and that's not where you serve. But nevertheless, you know what has to be happening over there. Do you think Mitch McConnell put out a checkmate move? Because for people that don't know, whereas people like Bernie Sanders and other senators said, look, let's just vote on a $2,000 overall payment. We'll send everybody $1,400 next year and let's keep it clean. Mitch McConnell said, I got a better idea. Let's vote on that $2,000. But while we're at it, let's talk about Rule 230. So President Trump and other people not happy with Twitter can go after them when they anger them. And by the way, while we're at it, let's create an election fraud board that will explore all the election fraud. Here's the thing. We know what he's doing. It's a poison pill. But is that a master chess move by McConnell?
I'm not sure it is this time. And here's why. There's two things going on. One is, you know, he could offer that up as a vote for people to take. But, you know, clearly that is not the bill that passed the House. And so nothing can become law before the session ends unless he votes up or down on the bill that passed the House. Which is, you know, the clean increase in the stimulus payments. The reason why, you know, that would obviously present a dilemma for his members is that, you know, some of them, for instance, the Georgia Senate candidates, want to, you know, get this done. And the only way to get it done is by actually voting on the House bill. Voting on the other bill, you know, would basically mean that the measure would die because Congress ends in 3 days. So the bottom line is, you know, there are millions, there are more than 10 million people unemployed. There are millions of families that need the money. They need it now. And they'll see through that measure, and they're both Republicans and Democrats. The question is, does he want to expose his members to their ire or their fury once they recognize that he just, you know, got people to vote on something that's going nowhere this Congress?
So what is your, you know, you mentioned the Georgia Senate races. That runoff is coming up next Tuesday. And if Mitch McConnell cares about anything, it's maintaining control of the Senate and becoming, you know, and remaining majority leader. So my question is, if essentially he kills this bill, which is what he's doing, if you are Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, you've come out, they both come out and said, hey, we support $2,000, but they never actually have to follow through with it. So it looks like they're supporting the president. Their constituents at home support the president. Is this also, does this hurt them, or does this help them, in your opinion, as you monitor politics back in the Georgia election?
It's very interesting. I think it depends on Trump, because Trump wants the $2,000, I think. I think he does want that to happen. It's part of his legacy, et cetera. And so if he decides to take to Twitter and say, you know, don't don't get caught up in this other bill, vote yes on both, you know, that will put a lot of pressure on McConnell. And the other twist here is that there's something called the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that next. Go ahead.
Yeah, that act is what funds the military. And it won, gosh, more than 350, 370 votes in the House, hugely bipartisan. Everybody wants to just override the president's veto on that and get it taken care of, you know, within the next day or two. Now, Bernie Sanders and maybe even others might basically say, look, we are not going to, you know, vote to allow that bill to proceed, the override, unless you, you know, have a clean up and down vote on the $1,400 additional stimulus payment. So it kind of all gets mixed up together a little bit, but that's, you know, I think how policy gets made in the Senate.
Well, and by the way, my understanding is that Pat Toomey and another senator are essentially stepping in and kind of killing the Sanders effort, but that's inside baseball. The bottom line is, let's say Sanders was successful and, you know, he demands his 2,000 vote, the more he pushes that off, I mean, that Congress, the Senate dissolves too. What happens to the National Defense Act?
That's a problem, to say the least, you know, because you know, basically, they don't have the money to fund a lot of military operations. I'm talking about things as basic as paychecks. I'm talking about pay increases for our troops who have, you know, it's like a 2 or 3% pay increase, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, these are people that are counting on it and they deserve it. But the bottom line is, I think that there would be a lot of heck to pay back in the home districts for a lot of people if that did not get passed this week.
Yeah, and it's of course, it's amazing that the reason for the president's veto is this Rule 230, which is this Twitter problem he's got. And he also doesn't want Confederate bases renamed for non-Confederates. And yet I have seen there were certainly some Republicans in the House, as you know, and there are some Republicans that don't want to challenge him. One Republican from Oklahoma said, look, he's the commander in chief. If he has his reasons for doing it, I'm going to stand behind him.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, that's, to me, that is a craven political move to vote for the NDAA in the first instance, the defense spending bill, and then to turn around and vote against it or vote to sustain the president's veto just because he is upset about Section 230 having to do nothing to do with the military, by the way, or, you know, saying that somehow it's in the best interest of the military to keep these bases named after Confederate soldiers, which is offensive. So I think that type of a vote is, you know, I think it'll come back. They'll be held accountable for it, hopefully.
January 6th, right after the holidays, is meant to be a sort of, you know, ceremonial day. The vice president counts the electors from the states. The new president, president-elect Joe Biden, should be announced. And everybody says congratulations and you all go home. That doesn't look like that's what's going to happen.
Oh, my goodness, no. I remember, you know, 4 years ago, I remember not remembering this this particular ceremony that happened because it was so unremarkable, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton lost, Donald Trump won, and we moved on. This time around, it's not going to be that way. There's going to be a lot of histrionics, theatrics, dramatics, whatever word you want to use, and we're going to be wasting a lot of time that day, you know, talking about the election and various conspiracy theories on the other side.
Well, by the way, we always knew there would be certain members of Congress, of the House, who were going to do this. You may or may not have known that one of your future colleagues, 15th District Congresswoman-elect Mary Miller, she will be objecting as well. She issued a press release today saying that she will stand with Trump and she will be electing as well. So that issue comes close to home. So here's the thing, and I believe the way this happens is it's state by state, right? So Arizona, Pennsylvania, every time a state is read off, that will be the opportunity for the House and the Senate, which are in joint session. At that point, a member of the House will stand up and say, I object. And then a member of the Senate has to stand up and say, I object, right?
That's right. And if they do, if one member of each body objects, then we basically go into debate, so to speak. And it's like a two-hour debate, I think, per objection. I want to read up on that again. But
it is. I can tell you it is per objection. It is.
Yeah. So you can just imagine what that day is going to be like. You could see, you know, I don't know if there's going to be six, I guess, pairs of objections is the right way to say it.
Yeah.
With regard to the six states that they've really focused on. But I could easily see a few, and certainly at least one. We heard that Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, is talking about objecting to Pennsylvania for some reason. And so there we have it. We're going to go into some kind of debate, and we all know what the outcome of that debate will be. There will be a vote, and we'll vote to sustain the Electoral College result. But I guess these people will be, you know, doing their they'll be fulfilling their fealty to the president in objecting.
Well, apparently Senator Hawley said he knows it's not going to change the result, but he just wants to call attention to all of this election fraud and this, you know, that has been going on. So let me ask you, listen, there, we've got people listening to us all over the country, all over the world, because we're on the internet as well. What do you say to people who say, yeah, the election, because listen, that's going to be a problem for President Biden as his term goes on. People who absolutely believe, because the current president has said this election was stolen, there was fraud everywhere, boxes and boxes of ballots being tossed in.
This is just bogus hogwash. I think that the Supreme Court has spoken on this. They dismissed out of hand the objections of not only the attorneys general of Texas and various other states, but also the amicus brief of 126 members of the House who claimed that there was election fraud. Obviously, we know that the Electoral College has spoken, including, by the way, Republican state legislatures in many of those states who decided to abide by the lawful election results. And so we're just spinning our wheels now, Paul. And I think that really the damage that these people are doing is not to necessarily Joe Biden, who is going to be the next president, but just to the institution of democracy. And that's you know, that's something that I'm always a little concerned about, to say the least.
What advice would you have? Let's just pretend that the one or both Georgia seats go Republican, because I know you're a Democrat and you could make a great argument as to why they won't. But it is Georgia. And so the odds are one or both seats go Republican. If that happens, what advice do you have for President Biden as he tries to govern? You'll have the House and Nancy Pelosi has a much slimmer majority. What can he get done?
I actually think he can get significant accomplishments through Congress, as long as he abides by, I think, the principles that he's kind of enunciated repeatedly post-election and even during the election. Namely, how do we get through this pandemic, Paul? How do we get through it in one piece, especially with regard to repairing the damage to the economy and then taking care of the healthcare crisis? Each of those obviously deserves probably an hour on your show if you could spare it. But, you know, with regard to the economy, I do think there's a broad consensus within the middle of Congress. And I point to a lot of Republicans as well who agree that, you know, we need to continue to help working families. We need to help schools. We need to help with the vaccination distribution process, as well as, you know, help struggling businesses. And, you know, I think that if we spend our time, you know, working on those issues, I think there's going to be tremendous agreement that that's a huge priority for the entire country. And I also think that if he continues to sound the note of unity, Paul, I do think that he was elected on a platform, a unity platform. And if he continues to talk about that and act in ways consistent with that, I think Americans will rally to his side, because this is a time when, you know, we're just seeing staggering losses due to the pandemic and people want to come together.
So I want to ask you a little bit about the population. You know, the population has dropped significantly in Illinois. This is redistricting time. Governor Pritzker has said he'll only sign a fair map. We could actually lose two seats. We know we're losing one, but from what I'm seeing, we might lose two. Out of curiosity, do you believe in the fair map that says, hey, look, if you lose a Democratic seat and you lose a Republican seat, or you lose two Democrats, so be it? Or would you say, now let's get the Madigans of the world in there and make sure that what we're trying to do is draw out the Republicans from Congress in Illinois? What would your view be?
You're trying to get me into trouble here. I honestly don't know how the redistricting process is going to go. It's funny. I was just talking to my staff this morning that the Census Bureau is behind already in reporting their numbers. We're going to have a change of administration and a new Commerce Secretary, and that person is going to have to see, okay, do we really report out the numbers if we feel that there are problems with those numbers. All of that's to say, I have no idea how this redistricting process is going to go down this year, especially the timing, which is crucial. In Illinois, we begin the petition process in, I think, September or so, and if we don't know what districts, you know, people are running for, that is really hard, because you got to get, you know, petition signatures in your own district. I don't know what's going to happen, honestly.
Yeah, I don't either. That's why I figured I'd ask you, because it's going to be a really interesting process to watch. And, God, so much going on. And, of course, you know, you're in the federal level of Congress. But, of course, what happens here at the state level is going to be impactful potentially to you.
Oh, yeah.
And all these races. It's going to be interesting.
Can I say one thing,
sure,
which is, I still think that one massive piece of business that we haven't taken care of with regard to the pandemic is we do need to provide state and local aid. It's getting to a crisis situation for many state governments, but also village governments and local governments. Paul, we've already laid off 1.3 million people. I'm talking about government workers across the country. And a lot of these executives are, you know, basically using Band-Aids and, you know, wire hangers to kind of hold their budgets together. And if they don't get the aid necessary, we're going to be laying off a lot of first responders, you know, firefighters, police officers, healthcare workers, teachers. And guess what? These are the people we need to reopen the economy and, you know, get people vaccinated and take care of the healthcare crisis. So it's all an issue that I think has to be dealt with very early on in the Biden administration.
Well, I won't say I envy you, but I will say that I wish you luck in going back for us. And to you, Congressman Roger Krishnamoorthy. And welcome back. Clarence Page is a Pulitzer Prize winning author and columnist with the Chicago Tribune. His great book called Culture Warrior. He's just an amazing guy, and we're here to talk politics. And if you have questions or comments for Clarence, 312-981-7200, you can phone or text that number. Hello, Mr. Page. How are you?
Oh, you're one of my favorite people, too. How you doing?
I am well, and I miss being with you on election night, because that's the way things are this year with the pandemic going on. But you joined us, you know, on WGN TV, of course, through the magic of Zoom, Skype, whatever we were doing. I don't know.
We're all living on Skype now, aren't we?
Exactly. Okay, we're almost at the end of 2020. Thank goodness. Right, let it go. Good riddance to 2020. When you look back at this year, Clarence, or somebody asks you in the future, what was the, forget the pandemic, what was the major political story of 2020? What strikes you as just the memory of 2020 with all that went on? Is there one?
Wow. You know, behind the pandemic, now we have to think for a moment. But, I mean, there was a presidential election that I think a few people cared about. So that's certainly, maybe that's just my Washington perspective here, but it certainly was decisive event in a lot of ways. And I mean, not just Trump's losing after only one term, but also the record turnout and the kind of political repercussions it's had around the country. I think we have to point to that and the pandemic as being the two big events of the year. Neither turned out to be great news for President Trump.
Yeah, let's combine those two for a moment, because my sense as the political analyst over at WGN TV is that without the pandemic, President Trump would have been reelected.
You know, it's probably true. I mean, I'm one who believes, who's been saying that for quite a while because he had the economy on his side. His approval ratings, he never got above 50% in his whole presidency, but he wasn't falling much below that. His base was solid. And the Democrats were in, I hate to say Democrats were in disarray because they're kind of always like that, at least in the on the national scene, but they were in the middle of a primary battle, you remember, in the earlier part of the year, that was really up for grabs. And Joe Biden kept sinking and sinking until he got South Carolina, and Jim Clyburn stepped in, endorsed him, and it turned his fate around, because until then, he lost New Hampshire and Iowa and Nevada, I recall. And then all of a sudden, he got revived in South Carolina. And then over the course of just a matter of days, really, the other Democratic candidates pretty much fall in line behind him. And I guess Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were the holdouts at that time. We're still keeping up something of a fight, but they too all pulled together in that rare event known as Democratic unity. So it was very decisive in that sense, and we can draw all kinds of meaning from how Joe Biden made that turnaround and what it means. In my view, it showed that for all of the talk in both parties about the far right running the Republican Party and the far left taking over the Democrats, moderation won in the end, I would say, wouldn't you?
Well, certainly, because Joe Biden is indeed a moderate. He's they can call him a socialist and all they want, but he's not that, and he's really not even a progressive on some issues, maybe. But let me ask you this: there's certainly a very large contingent of Americans who believe the election was stolen, that Joe Biden really didn't win it. And I'm wondering, you know, because Biden was not this electrifying candidate, right? I mean, even Pete Buttigieg got people sort of excited when he was in the race. But I sometimes wonder, was this really, the people who don't believe it was a Biden win, could it be because that a lot of people, while not excited for Joe Biden, were ready for a change from President Trump? And that's why you see situations like Georgia, where people voted for Biden at the top of the ticket, but then stayed true to their Republican roots, not enough to avoid runoffs, but then voted Republican down the ticket. And is that what you think? What might be feeding this sense that Biden really didn't win, because it was never really been about a Biden movement. It was all a response to President Trump. You love him or you hate him.
Yeah. Well, two things. For one, you're absolutely right. I mean, most Democrats I talked to said, I'm not crazy about Biden. He's not another Obama. He hasn't got the charisma, et cetera. But you know what you're getting with Joe. And the main thing is, you know, to say, I can't stand Trump. That was the reason why people were voting for Biden, voting for Joe Biden.
Right.
That was a real decisive factor here. And I said, that's no small thing. You know, there's two things that happen in an election. Somebody wins and somebody loses. And the fact is, it's not easy for an incumbent to lose if they've got a good economy going. But as I mentioned, there are these other factors that really tilted the balance. But there was a the other thing about Joe is that you know what you're getting. And just the very fact that you do know what you're getting, he's not known for surprises, not known for going around and offending people and laughing about it. And also, he's a man of ideas. He's a traditional politician in the good sense, as far as most people seem to be concerned. As much as politician gets to be a dirty word from a lot of people. The fact is, you want somebody who's a professional, who's going to really know how to run government, how government works, and isn't going to have his hand in the till all the time. These are pretty simple things that voters tend to ask. And Joe filled the bill. He is also on the upper edge of the understood age limits. I mean, this is the oldest president we have had, and that only underscores the fact that he may not be around for two terms. He may decide himself not to run again.
Yeah.
But the fact is that people. I think people have very utilitarian reasons for coming together around Biden. And when I say coming together, I mean the whole coalition, because he's a perfect political compromise, right? He didn't satisfy everybody. In fact, he dissatisfied most everybody, but he also satisfied what enough people were looking for that he was able to win. And so I think that's the people right now are, and he himself, in the beginning of his campaign, talked about how he was the no surprises guy and was going to bring some calm. He stopped saying that after a while because it kind of hit a certain point. He started getting diminished returns from boasting about being dull, you could say. But nevertheless, it was being put out there all by itself. He didn't need to go around bragging about how he's not Donald Trump. Everybody could see that. Yeah. And when it came down to Donald Trump, being obliged to reach out to people and show he was really engaged with the pandemic and show that he wanted to bring Americans together. He just wasn't really terribly interested in all that. So it really, that was the thing about Joe, which means that I think Democrats have bought some time. They've gotten themselves in the White House. They've stopped the hemorrhaging as far as their support is concerned, but they still couldn't pull off winning the Senate. And they also lost seats in the House. Those were two big surprises that should be a sobering wake-up call. I hate that term, but they needed a wake-up call when it came to caring about more than the White House.
Right.
That's going to be important here now as we look toward the ability of Republicans to hold on to Georgia. Not a done deal. I suspect that they will hold on to it, but you never know. This is a time of surprises.
Let me come back and talk about the Biden situation. If indeed Georgia gives control of the Senate to Republicans, and the smart money has to be on that, what does Joe Biden accomplish in a term with a Senate run by Mitch McConnell that is controlled by Republicans? That means judicial nominees have to be moderate. Any requests for tax increases, that's not going anywhere. But what happens?
Fairly moderate to liberal anyway, rather predictable, excuse me. I think, well, first of all, one thing about Joe Biden that he has in common with Mitch McConnell is they're both old Senate hands, and they both know how the system works, and they believe in the system. And one thing about Mitch McConnell is maybe he's getting tired now a little bit of just always saying no and just being
really?
Obstruction. So, and Biden himself has said this, that he knows Mitch McConnell, he knows the Senate, he knows how to get things done, and that he wants to work on issues that they can agree on or come to a reasonable agreement on. I'm thinking infrastructure right away, right? Remember infrastructure? How long have we been talking about fixing the roads and bridges and highways?
President Trump had an infrastructure week at the beginning of his presidency.
Yes, remember that. Obama and Donald Trump and George Bush, everybody promises to jump in infrastructure and fix it. And that was something Biden, by the way, had some experience with in that, I believe it was the second stimulus. He was in charge of implementing the spending that was going to help both fix up our old national monuments, et cetera, and put some more money into the economy. I think here's a case now where they can talk about this and get something done. That's something they've already got some agreement on. It's not like gun control and various other issues that are polarizing issues. I'm waiting to see now, because if they can't come to agreement on something like that, then we truly do have a gridlock and a system that is just paralyzed. I don't think McConnell wants to be remembered for that. As far as judicial appointments go, you're on the right track there. Mitch McConnell cares about judges, the Supreme Court, et cetera, more than anything else. He's very proud of himself for swinging the Supreme Court over to the right and for literally getting the pure obstructionist on getting a Merrick Garland's nomination blocked. That was Barack Obama's nominee, and the same excuse McConnell used for getting Merrick Garland's way, he just ignored when time came for him to put his own judicial appointees up.
Yeah.
But I think President Trump got some, you could say, justice in some way when the Supreme Court refused to back his bid to try to, in my view, steal the election. The court just left him out of the place as far as that was concerned. So he found that people don't pay back a Supreme Court appointment the same way, say, ward healers should traditionally paid back Chicago mayors. That doesn't work that way. But nevertheless, McConnell is a politician, hardcore, and does believe, though, in getting things done. And so I have a certain measure of optimism for he and Biden doing some things together, like infrastructure and other sort of, one could say, utilitarian issues, but not the hardcore ideological issues. You're absolutely right there.
So it means his listen, President Trump has reshaped the judiciary. I don't think there's any question about that. Probably not since Jimmy Carter reshaped the judiciary with women and minority groups. Carter's the one that put Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a judicial position. But President Trump certainly has reshaped the judiciary. That's probably not going to be a goal for President Biden. The fact that there is so much tension in this country, I mean, you know, all you have to do, you go on conservative media, and even President Trump has told his supporters, come on out to D.C. on January 6th. And I don't know what they're going to do there, but they're supposed to go out there. So he's certainly keeping this going. We're not even sure what President Trump will do. And I'll ask you this, on Inauguration Day, is he going to hold his own rally? I'm not putting a lot of money on him just attending the inauguration and doing what a former president does at an inauguration.
No, he's not going to. He's already indicated he's going to have a rally in Florida that day.
Yeah, so
night.
So how does President,
the same time as the inauguration?
Yeah, well, I'm sure it will be. How does President Biden, when he's dealing with a half a country who believes in President Trump, believes the election was stolen, all the things you can fill in, how does President Biden govern?
You know, I don't think he's going to have any trouble as far as governing and ignoring Donald Trump. He's done a pretty good job of that already. And I think that Donald Trump, remember, is a bluffer. When you call his bluff, he backs down. I can't remember a case where he didn't. And I don't think he is going to really. But the fact is, once he's out of that White House, yeah, he's always been an artist at getting publicity for himself. And for getting crowds aroused and for setting the theme of the day when it comes to the Washington politics or when it comes to Twitter. But the fact is that he is I think he's going to find that it won't be that easy to steal the spotlight entirely. I'm not that sure that he knows what he's going to do as far as his bluster behind getting people out on the streets or his bluster about the Proud Boys, et cetera, he doesn't really show that he has much of a strategy or a plan. But the one thing he does have is support of over 80% of Republican voters. That is not to be sneezed at. And that's why you find responsible members of Congress who are saying that they don't believe the election or they don't trust the way that the election was run, et cetera, even though they don't have any more evidence than Trump does that something was wrong. And frankly, let me say this for Trump supporters, because I know a lot of them. You know, I come from Middletown, Ohio, a hillbilly elegy country there.
And, yeah, right, right.
I know people who are Trump supporters and why they are Trump supporters. And I think a lot of them, or rather I know a lot of them, just love to hear him inflame the libs, all right? Trigger the libs, as they say. They love to hear him criticize the left and to be the national troll in chief make lots verbal jabs at the establishment because, you know, folks from towns like mine in southern Ohio there wound up as J.D. Vance says on the wrong side of globalism, have a lot of resentment for the us so-called Eastern elites or Chicago elites or whatever, liberal and media elites who didn't take them seriously and their problems seriously, in their view. I think Democrats need to work on that. I mean, remember back when Democrats were the party of the working men and women? I mean, this has been something they've been trying to get back ever since at least Ronald Reagan. And they have kind of hit and miss, which is, by the way, is another big reason why a lot of Democrats supported Joe Biden, because he has a over 40-year reputation as being a leading labor Democrat and one who working people trusted. And you saw that with the kind of turnout that he got in industrial areas.
Well, I'll tell you what, I could talk to you for another hour, Clarence, but unfortunately we don't get to do that. So I will thank Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, Pulitzer Prize winning author and columnist. His book is Culture Warrior. And Clarence Page, you're the best. Thanks so much for your time. Joining me is Cook County Commissioner Bridget Gaynor about what's coming up. Commissioner, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Good to talk to you, too. Yeah, thanks a bunch.
And Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. Almost
so
there.
There's all the... I can't get rid of this year fast enough.
Yeah.
So Congress, you know, finally gets its act together and does its thing.
Yep.
But let's bring it home to Cook County and our situation. What changes in this second stimulus moment? How does that impact us?
So let's talk about it in a couple of buckets. There's what do individuals get? What do you get if you're on unemployment? And then what's happened for a business? So the individual payments are not going to be the $2,000. I mean, that's pretty much assured now based on the way Congress is running it. So it's going to be $600. That's if you make up to $75,000. If two people earn together, they can make up to $150,000. The two adults get $600 each, but then so does each child. So if it's a married couple with two kids, they get $2,400. And so that goes to anyone, you know, married couples under 150 and individuals under 75. Now, if you're kind of, you know, times are much harder and you need either unemployment or rent insurance or rent assistance, the $600 we remember from last time, that additional what things went on top of the state, now it's $300. So if you apply for unemployment in Illinois, you get it from the state, you'll get an extra $300 payments, and that goes until March 14th. So, but if you are like a freelancer or an independent contractor, it's $100 per week.
Oh, wow. They never talk about that.
Yeah, well, they haven't, you know, I mean, this is the hard part about gig workers, you know, Uber drivers, deliver people. You know, you're not paying into the standard unemployment system in the same way, but we rely on these people so much, and they rely on income, much of which has gone away in the pandemic. So they're getting an extra bump onto their unemployment as well.
And do we know, it always people who are in the arts, actors, behind the scenes workers, they were the first to take the hit. They'll be the last to come back. Are they getting some help here?
Well, it's an interesting question because the individuals can apply for unemployment. They can get these extra bumps. But, you know, pretty much thanks to Jan Schakowsky and Mike Quigley and the guys like Joe Shanahan and Katie Tribben from Hideout and from the Metro, those guys worked really hard, and they have something in Chicago called Save Our Stages and Civil. They lobbied, they rallied everyone in the state, then they got people across the country to get special assistance for the theaters and the performing arts venues and the clubs. And so those businesses, in addition to the workers, are going to get some additional help to stay open because none of us wants to get to the other side of that pandemic and have no arts or culture or clubs, music venues that are able to survive because they can't deliver like the restaurants can. And even, you know, even as difficult as that is, they're in worse shape. So a huge shout out to those guys who made that happen.
And I know they worked with a guest I had on the show last week, Matthew Lee Erbach, who is an actor, a writer. He wrote The Doppelganger, for example. He was with me last week on the show. And he's helped create an organization called Be an Arts Hero. They worked closely with those Congress folks you just talked about. So important. And so rental eviction. So the good news for people who have been unable to pay their rent is that the moratorium on evictions has been extended. But those things that I've wondered, if I own a building and I have just like, you know, one unit, I'm just that tenant helps me pay for my own mortgage and stuff. What about the landlords? I mean, it's great for the tenants, but the landlords are going, the bank isn't telling me I don't have to pay.
No, it's a tremendous. It's a huge problem. And Chicago is loaded. I mean, my parents growing up had apartment buildings and, you know, lots of people, that's an income or a second income. And so there is really not a lot of relief for the landlords. The only thing kind of is the idea that if you've got your mortgage from HUD, they can't start a foreclosure till the end of February.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really help the landlords. There was a big push to try to get your mortgage expense, not just the interest, but your mortgage expense in a multi-unit building to be able to be deducted. And that didn't happen. And so there really isn't. I was just on a Zoom call last night with the National Association of Black Realtors, and they had about 1,100 people on this call. And that was one of the most common questions, because a lot of those guys own four flats, six flats. And, you know, that's the lifeblood of a lot of neighborhoods.
Sure.
And they're really in a hard spot. Yeah.
I mean, so the bottom line to it is, do we face a situation where tenants aren't paying the rent because they can't? And we respect that. I understand that. But then the landlords months down the line say, sorry, guys, I've lost the building.
Well, you know what's interesting? So 10 years ago, we obviously were in the middle of the financial crisis. And, you know, you and I talked about this issue. I started the land bank off of that and have spent a lot of time in kind of the what were the after effects of the foreclosure crisis. The one thing I hope we learned from that is when banks went aggressively to foreclose on properties, all of a sudden they got into the middle of it and thought, well, wait a minute, we don't want to take all this property back. What are we going to do about it? We better come up with better terms to let people be back. Unfortunately, that happened late into that whole financial crisis. So especially in places like Back of the Yards and Auburn Gresham, you saw a huge foreclosure crisis. My hope is the banks learned from that. We won't see people rushing to foreclosure, and banks will work out terms for forbearance, because at the end of the day, nobody wants to foreclose on a building. So how can we be a little bit more patient with people?
And, of course, you are a Cook County Commissioner, so is there any, in terms of recovering initiatives on the county level, anything specific we should know about?
Yes, there's rental assistance. The Cook County Land Bank yesterday just gave out, Tuesday just gave out $25,000 to families across Chicago and the suburbs on rent and mortgage assistance. There's some small business assistance. So if you go to, you know, Bridget.Gaynor@CookCountyIL.gov or any county website, you'll find all the assistance that's out there. But, you know, I'm glad they signed the pandemic bill. I'm glad we have some stimulus coming into the system. People are still going to lose that week of unemployment because it didn't happen fast enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's moving, and so that's something. And now for us, the biggest struggle is how do we find ways to keep, especially restaurants and these other hospitality venues, to help them survive until both the weather gets better and hopefully we get more people vaccinated.
All right. Yeah, this is it's going to be some crazy times ahead. Commissioner Bridget Gaynor. Congresswoman Marie Newman of the 3rd District is joining me now. Hey, Congresswoman, thanks for joining me.
Well, good afternoon.
So somebody would think that, oh, I'll bet they give them a couple of weeks to tour Washington, enjoy themselves. That's not happening, because on the 6th, on Wednesday, you will find yourself in what's supposed to be a ceremonial joint session of Congress. You'll be there. The Senate will be there. The vice president is supposed to preside over it. As all sorts of things are supposed to unfold, as many Republicans have said, they're going to do what they can to keep the electoral college votes from getting counted. What is your take on all of that and what you're going to be in for with what essentially is one of the first things you'll be doing in Washington?
Well, actually, right after we're sworn in, we actually start taking votes right away. So it's a full day. We'll be in session probably till late evening even. And we're taking votes on the 4th and 5th. And on the 6th is what was going to be ceremonial and still will be. You know, let's be clear that while some of these Republicans are choosing to actually take their, you know, their right and object to the count. It is clear, even Mitch McConnell, several other senior leaders in the Republican Party, as well as all Democrats, are very clear that it will go on as a certification process, and President-elect Biden will become President Biden.
So you're a small business owner. You know, you share a lot of the values, obviously, of your community. And we just know that, you know, the best Congress could do was give people $600. Even the president wanted them to get $2,000 for help. Democrats were behind it. I'm guessing one of the first orders of business when you get in there is continued pandemic relief. Do you have an agenda as what you want to see happen to help people back in your district, back in the state?
And it's what we've been fighting for all along, Paul. So we passed the HEROES Act back 8 months ago, which included support for small businesses, for individuals, as well as cities, towns, and states, health care, vaccine distribution, all of these critical things. We have met with nothing but obstruction and no response, quite frankly, just completely ignoring us for 8 months. We finally get it together and start getting it out the door. But that doesn't mean we're stopped fighting. We are going to continue to fight for a monthly allotment to help us get out of this horrible economic front we have, make sure we get money to the cities and states and counties to make sure that vaccine distribution gets back up and running again. The way it's been playing out is not satisfactory in any way. And making sure that we have unemployment insurance that extends to the place where we need it to be. So the fight continues. We do have small amounts going out the door, as you know, because of we approved the most recent relief package. But it is not near enough. We are all very clear on that. The Democrats fought for much more. We decided we should get some out the door and agree to this for now. And the minute that we have a new administration, we are going to get a new package underway.
President-elect Biden has made it clear that, you know, it's great to have vaccines sitting in the freezer, but the mission is to get them in people's arms.
Right.
I don't know if you've had the vaccine, but what message do you have for constituents to tell them it's okay, it's safe, you can take it?
It's 100% safe. You know, we have close to 3 million that have received it already, and it has been very successful so far, very minimal side effects. I actually will be taking it on Sunday morning, and I'm thrilled to do so, and couldn't be prouder as an essential worker to make sure that I get that and keep everybody safe around me. But it is incredibly safe. Look, this is one of the best rated vaccines of two centuries. You know, I mean, this is, they've done amazing work against this. And it's largely due to the inventiveness and the innovation here in the U.S. So couldn't be more excited about and grateful for receiving it. But we are going to employ the Defense Production Act so that it starts getting out faster to all of those key groups, frontline workers, essential workers, healthcare workers, nursing homes, hospitals, all of those places. So we make sure that we keep everybody safe.
You know, for the past 4 years, you could look at the rise of the national deficit. There's nothing partisan about that. I mean, it's risen by trillions and trillions in the last 4 years. And now when that effort came up to increase the amount of money people would get in the stimulus to $2,000 a person, it appears as though certainly the Republicans in the Senate have found kind of a new value with regard to budgets. We're now very concerned about the deficit. And again, I don't think that's partisan. I think it's just been, you can just look at the facts. That's what it's been for the last several years. So you've got a very bold agenda, infrastructure and many things. How are you going to proceed with that when you're now facing, and you've got to work across the aisle, when you're facing, you know, a newfound Republican concern, which is, hey, we've got deficit problems. No time to spend.
Yeah, and I will agree that the Republicans have created a horrible deficit situation that we are inheriting, and we will have to deal with it as in a bipartisan way. But let's be clear, over the last 4 years, it has skyrocketed because they've been giving givebacks and breaks to large corporations and to the very wealthy. So when you give tax breaks to the very wealthiest in our nation and corporations, you get a big deficit. That's just really clear. That's been proven decade after decade. That said, we have to deal with it as a team. We're going to move forward, and we're going to invest in the U.S. What everybody forgets, and particularly Mitch McConnell and his kind of depraved thinking around this, is that this is the American people's money. This is taxpayer money. So we should be investing it back in the American people. And the way we do that is the way we've always done it. When we've gotten out of the Depression, every recession is usually tied to a job program. And it's usually tied to things like infrastructure and transportation. Mm. So by putting together a green stimulus package that will provide workforce training, job growth across infrastructure, union jobs, green union jobs, as well as updating our transportation system, we're going to be more viable as a country, healthier, and our economy is going to be a 21st century economy.
I know that a point of pride for every new congressperson is, you know, the first bill they submit and watch it go through the process. So what will Congresswoman Marie Newman's first bill be that you submit for consideration?
Well, you know what you do as a freshman is you work really hard and try to support ongoing legislation to make sure that your district is supported. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things I do, rather than doing something glossy and by myself, I'm going to be very supportive to the stimulus package and make sure we bring money for transportation and infrastructure projects back to my district, Illinois 3. We have a great opportunity to do that because of the nature of the stimulus package. In addition to that, we have a reauthorization package of the Transportation Act, and so we'll be bringing money back. So it's all about what we're going to bring back to the district at this point. And then on the heels of that, there are several small business bills that I think that we can get through that will help small businesses. One of the things I'd like to partner on with some other folks that are already working on it is a restaurant relief program that will likely be part of the next relief project, or excuse me, package. Mm-hmm. But I also think there's a bill in the offing there that can give more relief to small businesses under 10 employees as well as restaurants.
Well, you've got quite the agenda. I can't say that I envy you, because I wouldn't want to go do what you're doing, but I respect the fact that you're about to go off to Washington and take care of the concerns of the people's business of the 3rd District. Congresswoman Marie Newman.
Thank you so much.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.